Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age test? Well, I took it myself and the results are in. I found out my biological age, which directly predicts my risk for serious diseases. Here's why that matters. Research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. The good news is, nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hand. Yes, it's driven by things like your lifestyle, which means you have a lot of control over it. I was pleased to see my biological age was 6 years younger than my chronological age. That felt like a big win because I've definitely put a lot of time and attention on improving my lifestyle habits so they are more aligned with my health goals. The test also showed a few areas to work on and even pointed out a low level of riboflavin or vitamin B2, which plays a huge role in energy metabolism. It's strange because I felt there was something inhibiting my energy, and now I have a simple theory I can test. The True Age test didn't just give me a number, it showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, no doctor visit or big needles, just a quick, painless finger prick. You send off that tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com and use my code MINDFUL to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code MINDFUL at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. It's kind of wild how easy it is to feel disconnected from where our food comes from these days. We grab something off the shelf, toss it in the cart, and that's that. But every now and then, you come across something that reminds you, hey, real people grew this. Here's something real for you. 90% of American-grown frozen red raspberries, they come from a tight-knit community of farmers in Washington State. These are multi-generational family farmers, folks who've been working the land for decades, taking real pride in every berry they grow. This isn't just farming, it's legacy. It's local and it's done with heart. These frozen Washington red raspberries are honestly juicy, delicious, and full of flavor because they're grown in nutrient-rich soil and frozen right at peak ripeness. It feels good to enjoy something that's not only high quality, but also backed by care, tradition, and purpose. These berries, they're not just tossed in a freezer. They're grown with intention by people who've dedicated their lives to perfecting them. From sustainable farming to state-of-the-art freezing techniques, everything is done to lock in flavor and nutrition. Whether you're cooking, baking, smoothie making, or eating straight from the bag, frozen Washington red raspberries give you the real taste of American farming. And yeah, you can tell the difference.
Go to redras.org and look for Product of the U.S. to learn more.
So there's a sensitization that goes on both at the tissue level and also in the central nervous system, which has a number of factors, but one would be it's going to respond with a lower threshold. So right now, as we're sitting here, there's what we call nociceptive signals. These are like the progenitors of pain that might become pain, but a lot of the time they just get inhibited because the central nervous system decides, yeah, this isn't important. There's no threat. So if I think there's something coming from my toe, well, there can't be something coming from my toe. There's nothing, there's no threat of my toes.
Dr. Mark Olson, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a PhD in neuroscience and seem to work with pain.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the topic of pain.
When you reached out to me, that definitely resonated with me too. There's, I guess, people very close to me and my family that have been plagued by pain for a very long time. And one thing that has been obvious is the strategies used to help them don't help.
Yeah.
I mean, they help them get through the day, maybe emotionally, but it doesn't seem to be, the strategy doesn't seem to be even like touching the surface at all of what is really underlying driving pain.
Uh-huh.
And so progress not only doesn't get better, but it seems like it gets worse. Like the medications, the interventions that the Western medical model has provided, they make it worse because they wind up desensitizing receptors so that whatever pain, like medication they need, becomes less effective over time and they need more of it. So any associated side effects with those medications also get worse over time because the dose has to continue to get greater.
Yeah.
And what a frustrating like spiral to watch somebody to go through, you know, when they're close to you.
Absolutely.
What brought you to wanting to study pain? Was this dealing with your own pain, or how did it come about?
Well, I too have close family members who struggle with chronic pain, so there's a personal element. Also, just because I work in the field of manual therapy, and so, you know, massage therapists are always working with pain. That's one of the main things that people come for. It's, you know, really important that we understand it well. I mean, it's kind of a strange thing that pain isn't one of those required things to learn about in manual therapy education. You'd think that it would be on the list of requirements, but it's actually not. And I don't know why that is, but it's maybe because it's really complex. But what we normally do teach about it in massage school programs, for instance, you know, isn't correct. It's just as incorrect as what most of us think about pain, because we're basing it on this kind of like childlike model that, you know, we get owies, you know, when we're kids because we fall and scrape our knees. So we associate pain with tissue damage. Then we become an adult and we start to realize that we can have pain without tissue damage, but we're still thinking in terms of tissue damage. So that just continues into the healthcare profession of, well, we're just going to look for, maybe there's some kind of tissue damage that we don't know. We'll find a picture of it. You know, we'll do a blood test. And if we can't find it, then we'll just say it's in your head and you're imagining it. So, you know, all of that is just a mess. And if we want to really help people, we have to really understand what's going on.
Yeah, I assume that we've made a lot of progress over the last few decades of understanding that. I don't know if it's like trickled down to standard operating procedures in a typical medical setting. I do remember reading a study, I want to say it was maybe a decade ago, where they were looking at back pain, where I think they were using MRIs and trying to draw links between what you would think would be causing pain from the picture and what somebody's experience is. And I mean, the moral of the study was basically, you could have an MRI that looks like you should have a lot of pain and not have, but you could not have pain. And you could have a lot of pain where there's nothing to see there on an image. Which begs a question, like, what even is pain? Like, where does it reside?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, the official definition of pain is that it's a sensory experience that has emotional components too. But it's kind of a funny thing because we know that there's been other studies where, so there's two main areas in the brain that are relevant to the discussion. One is the somatosensory cortex, which is where all touch information goes and tells you where something is happening. And then there's the limbic cortex, which provides this emotional, aversive kind of quality to it. So we know that if we knock out activity in the limbic cortex, people will say that they experience pain, but it doesn't hurt, or they don't mind it.
Wait, they do that with people? How do you knock out that section of the brain?
Well, transcranial magnetic stimulation, where you go in and you can affect the activity in the neurons through magnetic activity.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So a lot of experiments are done with that, where we get to play with the brain, turning things on and off.
I was going to say, I can't imagine an IRB approving you to like take a section of brain out to do the test.
No.
Okay, so you're you're manipulating the signals that are being received through magnetic stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of fascinating studies with transcranial magnetic stimulation. But this one is showing that this is the very definition of pain is kind of funny if someone says it's painful, but I don't mind it, because minding it is part of the definition. If you do the converse, if you knock out the somatosensory cortex, people will describe having an unpleasant feeling, but they can't tell you where it's from.
That's interesting.
So both of these things are happening.
So they feel the non-physical parts of pain, but they can't identify its location?
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what that experience must be like.
Right, right.
Is that like what it feels like to be sad or just down? Like, it's not in your body, but you feel it?
I wish they had done more of that kind of questioning, asking, so what is it like, and have a more phenomenological angle on it.
Well, if somebody, so let's say like I have a loved one that has had chronic back pain for a long time, but there's like variability, like, and I know I've experienced this, like everybody's had their back pain at some point, or most adults have had it at some point. And there'd be this weird, like, spontaneous ebb and flow where, like, it's there, it's not there, it's there, you move this way, it's there. And sometimes there'd be, like, no movement associated or just, like, maybe a breath or whatever, and it would change. And it's like, if it's structurally at the place that you're sensing it, would that really happen? Or is this all just interpretation in the brain? Like, where does the pain reside when someone says their back hurts?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of mystery here for sure. Clearly, if there was, oh, every time I move this way, this happens, if there's a very direct relationship, then we know we're in the realm of there's something there with the tissue. Maybe it's sensitized, you know, but we're still tissue-based in its origin. But if we see that there's not a strong relationship between those kinds of movements, and there's strong relationships with when I'm having a bad day, when I have a fight with my partner, when I'm under stress, when I didn't get enough sleep, those kinds of things, then we're talking about more complex processing in the central nervous system, and it's probably less about what's going on in the periphery.
Okay. There's also seems
more.
Yeah, sure. I mean, before you do, I would like to hear more. There's also seems to be like a lot of individual variability as far as tolerance. I mean, I know that I could be like a real wimp when it comes to pain. And I know like my wife or my son, who's like got a history of skateboarding, like he would get injuries that I would be whining to everybody in my life about. And he just like, if you didn't see the blood, you wouldn't know he was hurt. Like he wouldn't even tell anybody. He would just like go on with his day.
Right. Well, so a lot about pain processing has to do with the anterior cingulate cortex, which is part of the limbic system. And the anterior cingulate is often involved with like deciding whether this is important or valuable or connecting it with meaning. I mean, it's hard to just give one label to the anterior cingulate, and other parts of the limbic system are involved in this too. But, you know, if you think, hey, this was cool versus, oh, that was terrible, or I'm going to get my fun of, or this is the end of my career, or now I'm just going to get stronger. You know, it's kind of the story that you add to it, you know, certainly contributes to the picture. It's not just, you know, it's not the only part of the picture, but people with trauma, you know, have on average a different kind of nervous system in terms of how they respond, both in terms of the sensitization, like the actual neural mechanisms, but also in terms of the story, like, am I going to be supported in this or am I not going to be supported in this? And so if you have a history of really not being supported, that's probably not going to go as well later on. I mean, again, we can't make any like across the board statements, but
what's the neural mechanism then? It, like for someone that has trauma to experience pain or be affected by pain more?
Well, you could just have more of an inflammatory state, for instance. I mean, the whole nervous system is being more vigilant. So there's a sensitization that goes on both at the tissue level and also in the central nervous system, which has a number of factors, but one would be it's going to respond with a lower threshold. So right now, or as we're sitting here, there's what we call nociceptive signals. These are like the progenitors of pain that might become pain, but a lot of the time they just get inhibited because the central nervous system decides, yeah, this isn't important. There's no threat. So if I think there's something coming from my toe, well, there can't be coming something come from my toe. There's nothing, there's no threat at my toes. So those are knocked out all the time. But in chronic pain conditions, some of the neurons that normally inhibit that, they die. And so they don't do their job. And so you have these random signals pop up occasionally, or they spread when they shouldn't spread. So there's a lot of inhibiting mechanisms that are no longer functioning like they're supposed to. But also, it doesn't take as much to get the next neuron to move up to the brain. Like it normally gets stopped at the spinal cord, but sometimes it just gets a pass and gets to move all the way through.
So when those neurons die, are there interventions that can support the like creation of new ones that serve their purpose, like whether it's nutritionally or?
I don't think anyone knows the answer to that question at this point. However, normally in the central nervous system, when things die, it's not a good story for coming back. So I'm just going to provisionally say, I'm guessing that they don't come back, but that a person coping with that will have to use another strategy to work with the system. Because there's a whole system from tissue to the insula, which is basically the part that's going to say, this is how I feel. And that, you know, there's a number of places where we can intervene. You know, if you go out and get a massage, that intervenes in certain ways. If you are having support, caring support versus not, that affects things in certain ways. The, you know, the medicines help in certain ways. So, you know, going out and doing things that are meaningful or and feel good to kind of override it or distract from it is affecting it another way. So a person, if they don't have those inhibitory signals in place, they might have to use other mechanisms. So the inhibitory signals that I was just referring to are ones that are within the spinal cord. They just hang out at the spinal cord. But there's other signals that come down from the brainstem down to the spinal cord that are inhibiting. And we know, like with fibromyalgia, that those signals are operating like they should. But maybe it's just a matter of priming them. It could be a chemical situation, or it could be that we just need to do things that push those further. So for instance, if I say to you, yeah, I think you're screwed. Yeah, it's going to really suck for you. That's different than me telling you, you know, you're going to be okay. You know, we're going to take care of this. That, you know, is a placebo effect.
For sure.
And it's not magic. It's real neural signals that travel from one part of the nervous system to the other. So we can use that. That's happening all the time. You know, I feel like this is a safe place, so I'm going to think that I'm going to be fine. Well, I think this is a dangerous place, so I don't think it's going to be fine. We can use that in different ways. But what we know with fibromyalgia is that that system isn't working quite as well as it is normally. So they may just have to boost it one way or the other.
Gotcha. It's interesting. You mentioned something a moment ago about, I guess, if you're doing something, I think you alluded to something like if you're doing something that provides pleasure in some way, like it's oppressed. It made me think of this same loved one who has chronic back pain, life, you know, chronic depression that I'm sure is associated with it. And when he is with, there's like a handful of people in his life that are like close cousins that has all these like positive memories from when they like lived on the same street when they were little. And you wouldn't know that he's plagued by pain 24 hours a day on those rare occasions that he's with these people that are his cousins. It's like they bring him back to a different time in his life.
Yeah.
Where that pain wasn't there. And you could noticeably see, like, the pain's not on his mind. Like, it's something's coming downstream to, like, inhibit some negative perception of whatever is usually there in the physical body.
Yep. Yep. I mean, we have to start with the understanding that most of what's going on isn't conscious. And most of our experiences are being mediated by subconscious processes. So it's not a surprise when we find that something is going on that affects our conscious experience. And so, you know, what is that thing? You know, is it bringing up some kind of developmental, you know, trauma? Which, when I say that, it doesn't mean that anybody was doing anything bad. It's just the way we interpreted things as children. And, or, you know, that there could have been some conflict there that isn't even directly related to the cousins. It could be just related to the family context in general. I mean, who knows, right? Who knows?
Right.
That, and he doesn't know because he probably doesn't have a explicit memory. But those things, you know, there's still limbic subconscious mechanisms that could be influencing circuits. They could be changing the neurochemistry. You know, I'm just speculating about possibilities.
Right. It just makes you wonder, if that can happen just subconsciously when we're not intentionally doing it, like there's probably just so many things that we can do that could acutely inhibit a pain signal. Like I know just from exercise, like my history of exercise, there was a time where I had a lot of low back pain and it dictated a lot of my like physical activity. I had MRIs that said I had bulging this and herniated that. And now like my back feels great. I would say 362 days a year, you know, have a few bad days. But one thing I know, that there's been times where it's been like not 100%, and then just getting my body moving and get like, and it goes away. And there's been days where I almost didn't exercise because of pain, but then I like forced myself to do it. And I was so glad because like then I felt better after. Like, where did that go? So you do body work, manual therapy?
Yeah. I haven't actually done it in a while because I've been teaching it and directing schools that do it. So I don't have an active practice anymore yet.
But in your experience, Mark, is there like a type of tissue or a place in the body that generally seems to store some of this stuff we can't make sense of, like whether it's the emotional pain or those older traumatic experiences where it is held, like this idea of the body keeping a score and holding things if they're not, I don't know, properly processed or something? Like I've heard people talk about the fascia, that it like is where stuff is held. Is there an area that a body worker winds up gravitating towards to help, or type of tissue to help someone that's dealing with pain?
No, it doesn't work that way, even though that's a very common way for people to think of it and a common way to interpret The Body Keeps a Score, which is an excellent book that I, you know, give thumbs up to. But the idea that the body keeps a score is this idea that the body is influenced by trauma, for sure. And, you know, there's all these impacts. But the idea that it's stored in the body is really more of a metaphor. It's not what's really happening. It's not a thing that's stored. Trauma isn't a thing inside of tissue. And a lot of body workers think this way because they notice that when they work with the body, things come up. And so it kind of has that appearance to it. But this is all a neuropsychological pattern. Trauma is a neuropsychological pattern. And it's not a thing that can be removed, like a demon we would use to do exorcisms, right? So it's not a thing to excise. Trauma is something a person lives with, they adapt to. It's a pattern they work with for the rest of their lives. It's not a thing that just like you can just disappear one day. So, I mean, I could talk forever about this idea of fascia and how it relates. But the thing is that when we're working in a way that we think we're working with fascia, actually a side note here, fascia doesn't actually change during a session. It's not something that can be, like the actual tissue itself can't be manipulated in a like a way that we like think about taffy, for instance. So you can move it around, obviously, but you can't really change its actual structure. It can only change over a period of weeks or months based on the intrinsic forces that a person applies when they're doing what they're doing in their life.
It can't change from like neurological signaling of like safety and then all of a sudden it like glides better, or?
It's not going to respond to neural signals. I don't know of any kind of way that it can respond to neural signals. Muscles respond to neural signals and muscles are attached to fascia. So if you change the muscle tension, smooth muscle or skeletal muscle, you're going to get a change in the tension on the fascia for sure. So I think a lot of what people experience is those changes. And maybe there's some other kind of changes going on, but it's not fascia responding to neurons as far as I know. And I don't know what that mechanism would be. So before anybody should postulate that, they would have to really show evidence for that idea. But since it doesn't really align with what we understand about fascia and the nervous system, before they say that, they need to outline that. So this idea that it's in the tissues is because when people work with fascia, it's usually a very slow kind of process. You have to be attuned. You have to move in this way that pretty much brings some more somatic awareness. Hopefully there's a sense of safety. When that happens, that allows for vulnerable feelings to arise. And there's a whole topic here about posture, and people think about posture in this way that I kind of think is kind of boring, that it's just a bunch of tissues fastened together and we just need to, like, there's this one way to have posture that's the best way. But I find that to be it's incorrect, because the evidence shows that there isn't a way that's best. When people go into that, if they haven't been in that, they don't feel better. But more importantly, there's a whole psychological dimension. So if, you know, I hold myself, you hold yourself in the way that feels best. And some of that is because this, you know, that if I did this all day, I probably wouldn't feel comfortable. This is how I feel comfortable. But another part of it is the psychology. If I have a whole bunch of, like, if we were to start talking and I started to feel like crying and I didn't want to cry on screen, I would probably move a certain way to like not make sure I didn't cry. Right. So We can do that all the time. We can force ourselves into a position to make sure we don't feel certain things we don't want to feel. And for some people, that's chronic. So you start to think about like how trauma relates to pain and posture, because if someone doesn't want to feel something from their past because it's too painful, they can adopt a certain posture to make sure they don't feel it. Maybe it's a really like upright, tough posture, for instance. But what they're doing, though, is putting themselves into a position that is contrary to what the body might want to do otherwise. Like, if this isn't comfortable, like physically, but they're forcing themselves to do it so they don't feel emotional pain, I would imagine that those folks are going to show up with a different pain profile than somebody else who's not having to do that all the time. So, but guess what? When a person lands on the table in a treatment room, it's the one time where they don't, while they're awake, that they don't have to hold on to that posture. They can sort of start to let go. And when you let go of that posturing, then you become aware of the feelings that you were trying to suppress before. And so it looks like people are, quote, releasing trauma, or, but it's way more nuanced and complicated than, plus we also wouldn't want to like release things just like that. It's kind of opening a can of worms, and just expressing feelings isn't the same as healing. It's, in the many cases, it's actually makes things worse for people. So there's a whole lot to that topic that I would really love to see people understand, that it's not a thing that's stored, and it's not a thing that we should be trying to release. We should have an understanding that we've created a safe space where people have now felt okay, and now they're getting access to things that they maybe didn't have access to before.
Gotcha. But you do think that the past experiences can lead to us kind of gripping and like creating postures that don't necessarily, well, they might serve us in some way, but they over time are like maladaptive strategies that don't serve us.
Delicious meat, nutritious. Crack into a good source of protein with tasty, healthy, Wonderful Pistachios. Wonderful Pistachios is a complete protein, providing all 9 essential amino acids. In fact, each 1 ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios contains 6 grams of protein. Pistachios have got to be the tastiest nut. Pistachios are delicious, they pack a nutritional punch, and are oddly fun to eat. It's like a little dopamine drop every time you hear that shell crack open. Personally, I like them roasted and salted, but you can find your favorite shell or no shell variety at wonderfulpistachios.com. Whether you're running between meetings or dropping off the kids, Wonderful Pistachios are the snack that works as hard as you do. Check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more about this healthy, tasty snack.
Right, right. Well, I mean, they're definitely adaptive. If, like the one example I was giving, they're adaptive. I don't have to feel that grief, for instance. But they're maybe maladaptive because now I'm holding myself in a position that doesn't make my tissues happy.
Right. I've been talking with somebody a little bit recently. He's actually my guitar instructor that works with like the Alexander technique. He might actually be coming on the podcast to chat about it. But are you familiar with the Alexander technique at all? Okay. But one thing that, and I'm not very well versed on it, but one thing that stood out early on was that there was this component of like, you don't have to do anything. The goal here is to stop doing what you're doing. Like, you have a history of misusing your body. So we're just going to start over by try not to misuse it. And the place to start was like laying down, where you don't have to hold yourself, so that you could gain a little bit of like awareness of like maybe where you're gripping, and it's easier to just, you don't have to let go, just stop gripping, like start. And it was interesting. Like, I come in from a gym environment where I did learn that there is an ideal posture, essentially, based on the anatomical design. And I don't know if I disagree with that yet. I don't know what's like absolutely true. You seem to have some really good ideas. I've heard a lot. I could be easily convinced of a lot of different ideas, even though they may compete or they might just be intertwined in some weird network of ideas. But like, we would say, well, the form is born out of the function. So like, the architecture that we present with evolved out of the need to survive, like, and whatever that means, like, oh, you got to move, you got to find food, you got to procreate, you got to fight battles, you got to be able to climb a mountain to maybe predict the weather, whatever survival meant. And then, like, this structure was born out of that need. Like, the way that we have two legs, a trunk and two arms and a neck and a head all lined up in a certain way. And there definitely seems to be, like, a efficient way to transfer force through that body. And yeah, in some ways, you could look at moving as, like, the organization or the transfer of energy in the form of force through the body. And when it's not efficient due to whatever insult, whether it's mental, emotional, physical trauma, you fell, you twisted your sacrum, and now you operate this way, like, whatever the thing is, there'll be some kind of, like, inefficiency. But because we still have a desire to survive and move forward, we will compensate. We will create some kind of compensatory strategy that over time will affect us negatively, or, like, just our habit. So, for instance, if you're a child and you move freely in the world and then you get a desk job and then you're at a desk 8-10 hours a day, you have structural changes. And because that structure was born out of the need to function, by definition, once that structure is altered, let's say you're totally flexed over and your shoulders are internally rotated or whatever, that you lose function. Like, one thing that you commonly see in the gym is people that come in with, like, jacked up desk posture have lost overhead mobility, for instance, like their T-spine or shoulder can't operate. So we would look at providing environments to encourage a movement back towards whatever we thought was the efficient posture, with the idea that maybe there's not perfect, there's no, like, but there's a direction that you're aiming, that you're, like, working towards. And you're saying there is no, well, maybe I'm wrong, but are you saying that there is no, like, efficient posture? Like, there is no ideal posture?
No. Okay. Yeah. I'm glad we're clarifying this. It's very important. So clearly there's going to be a physics that creates the greatest efficiency and that kind of thing. And it's especially important if we're talking about performing at high levels. Although it should be noted, you know, that, like, Usain Bolt, you know, fastest guy in the world,
pretty jacked up,
you know, major pronation, and he's fine. But yeah, anyway,
he's got asymmetries. Yeah. Yeah. Nobody fix. Yeah, sometimes you see things, you're like, don't fix that.
Yeah.
Because it's working.
But, you know, yeah, there's going to be this efficiency thing, but that's efficiency and function is different than experience with pain.
Okay.
So I think that's where people go. They go, they assume that if it's not ideally functional, that then there's going to be pain. But there, you know, but there isn't. If you can find newspaper articles from 150 years ago where people are like, oh, these people reading newspapers, they're going to get tech neck, basically.
Interesting.
But they didn't. People were fine reading newspapers. And, you know, clearly, you know, holding your head over takes more work than having it aligned, you know, in a certain way. But that doesn't translate to having more pain. So that's the key thing, is not thinking that one has to be a certain way to feel pain. People have pain. People with scoliosis don't have more pain than people without scoliosis.
They don't, even on average, like, because I know some people with scoliosis that have pain, but sure, when they're studied across population, there's no difference there.
I'm not going to quote a for sure, like, overall population, but you can definitely find individuals with scoliosis who are fine. And you can find people who have Greek god bodies who aren't. So it's not, the correlation's not there. Study after study doesn't show any relationship between, to the degree to which they have, look like a Greek statue, to how good they feel.
So what do the studies show that are, like, strong correlates? Is it, like, the childhood traumatic experiences that just increase the probability, or, like, putting aside, like, car accidents type stuff?
Yeah. Well, movement is the thing that correlates the most. So lack of movement is the big problem. So you sit at the desk all day, we tend to think, oh, the problem is that we're shortening your psoas major, and then that does this thing where it pulls on the lumbar spine. It doesn't shorten your psoas major, but it probably does, you know, make you more make it maybe more difficult, you know, you're to move in other ways that are different than that. But it doesn't, it's the lack of movement that is correlated with the pain. It's not the positionality of it. If a person sits at a desk all day, it's actually more important that they just get up and move, you know, every hour for a minute. And then they do way better than those who don't do that.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the stillness that we have, the lack of movement, is very new in the scheme of our history. Is it, you know, it wasn't that long ago that people had to move, you know, a large percentage of the day to just get the stuff done that you had to do that day. And this, I mean, I don't know, it could be looked at as a consequence, the luxury or consequence of progress or whatever, but you're right. Like, there's people that sit at, that have desk jobs that are still very active people. And, you know, it would simulate more, they're more connected, even though they might have a desk job, to what is more natural because of the total amount of movement they get in on like a weekly basis. But the product of like sitting down to have breakfast, sitting down in your car to get to work, sitting down at work, sitting in your car to get back, then sitting to have dinner, and then sitting to watch a few shows before bed, like, that's very unsustainable if you want to have a high quality of life, it seems,
yeah,
and feel good in your body. But yeah. I also believe that even though ideally you want to have like lots of movement and have it like sprinkled throughout your whole like day or week, that for a lot of adults that think that it's an overwhelming thing to like overcome, the minimum effective dose is, I think, a lot smaller than people might think. Like, they have an idea in their mind that they have to go take a yoga class every day for an hour, or go to the gym 5 days a week. And it could be so much less than that. But there's something to be said for like breaking up the day and just slowly reducing the amount of minutes that have, I would say, like negative environments. Negative meaning like they just don't align with something you care about as far as how you want your body to feel and how you like want to be able to play with your grandkids or whatever. And then increasing slowly the minutes of positive environments where there's, you know, your eyes are gazing farther, there's information coming in, you're perceiving, you know, how you are in the space around you, and your limbs are moving around, and you're pumping lymph because you're walking down the street or whatever. It's, there's all these benefits from these like just little doses. And
I think we've learned that you're supposed to do 30 minutes a day of 80% heart rate, right? And most of us think, well, I guess I'm not going to pull that off, so I might as well just pull up a chair and watch television. So, but I think the research now really shows pretty clearly that, you know, that's actually more of a harmful idea that limits people, and we should just get out there and do little things, like you said.
Yeah, I don't use the word expert a lot, but I consider myself an expert in filling the little opportunity gaps through the day to, and like for me, what that looks like is I'm very quick to get on the floor. Like, I find the floor being the most nourishing piece of exercise equipment that there is. And I think in even just like 2 to 5 minutes of doing something that resembles what a baby would do on a floor a few times a day is like, that's the fountain of youth. If there is a fountain of youth through the lens of movement, it's doing what a very youthful person would do, or something similar.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm quick, like in every room in our house, there's like little bucket of soft tissue tools. There's like things that are inviting you to like get down on the floor, whether it's a foam roller, or now there's like a whole world of different soft tissue massage tools. We have the compression gums or whatever they're called, like a couple of them in the house. If I'm waiting for water to boil, I'm doing some single leg work while, you know, I have this one habit where I roast coffee every couple weeks. And for me, roasting coffee means every 20 seconds, I'm like shaking a pan for about 20 minutes. So like, what do you do when you have 20 seconds to spend over and over? Well, I'll do like one rep on each leg of a thing, or three push-ups, or whatever, or like eye exercises or neck exercises. So I'm always like looking for those. And I think personally that a lifestyle like that is probably, there's probably more to offer from a feel good in your body perspective than hitting the gym for an hour hard three times a week. And then sitting on your ass the rest of the time thinking you've made up for all that because you threw a lot of weight around.
Yeah, because there's the movement piece and there's a sensation piece. And then there's also a focused attention piece, right? You're on a task, you're doing that rather than attending to screen, for instance, or like we're promoting here.
So. Well, you know, the nice thing about podcasts, I mean, they've been very helpful for me as far as like my, the amount of walking I get done now. Like I, you know, if there was a time where if I wanted to take in content, I'd be looking at a book or something. Or so YouTube and podcasts has allowed me to do this thing that I like, which is like, learn shit. Like I'll learn about so many different things. I just like it. It's like, I don't know if it's an addiction or, but I could do it while I walk. So it's got me like much quicker to go for an after meal walk in my neighborhood, knowing like, oh, I want to finish the second half of that podcast I was listening to. And it allows us to harness the value of this technology and have it channel in something where we're multitasking in a very positive way.
That's meaningful, right? So working at the gym isn't meaningful.
It can be. I would fight back. I mean, for many people, it's a sanctuary. I mean, it is their, I don't want to say necessarily like safe space, but it's their church. You know, like when I arrive to the gym and I get on the floor and acknowledge like, oh, the next hour is for me. I do like that. I feel good there. But that's also my hobby. It's a place where I've done a lot of thinking. It's a place where I've gone inward a lot through my movement practice. It's, you know, it could be different for different people. But like my son, he has no interest in going to the gym. He would rather drive across the country to hike a big mountain, you know, and that's, and for me, like, that's terrifying. Like the altitude, the am I going to get sick? Like, are there going to be bears? Like fun for him is like borderline trauma for me, just the fear associated with like, am I going to die on this mountain? Whereas going to the gym is like, oh, I love it here. But like, he's like, why would you want to, like, I don't know if it's the structure of it or like the, you know, artificial mechanical nature of a gym environment, like doesn't do anything for him. It's like a waste of time for him.
Yeah. I mean, everyone has to find what's meaningful and motivating. And
so what do you do? What's your movement practice look like, Mark?
My movement practice is usually about, you know, working outside, landscaping.
Oh, like task oriented. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. I could do that all day, every day.
That's great. It's funny because in the gym, I would identify like qualities to cultivate in someone's like journey, especially in like the beginning when you're setting goals. And it used to be when I thought I knew everything when I was younger, it was like very like strict, like strength or endurance or power. And as I got older, I added qualities like tasks, like do you garden? Do you have to chop wood for your fire? Or play, you know, directionless exploration, whatever. It was like, there's a lot of things that we could fit in here.
Yeah.
That count towards like your overall physical routine or whatever.
Absolutely.
And the older clients that I work with, I mean, one thing that stands out is the ones that do a lot of like housework or landscaping and tend to the garden or whatever, you know, there, it's obvious that there's something really good about that. I mean, you're checking a lot of boxes. You're getting sun, you're connecting with your environment. You might be getting dirt. You might be influencing your microbiome by all the dirt you're dealing with. Or
yeah, it's very multi-layered for sure.
Let's circle back to, so how do you think that, what other ways is that associating, is that affecting pain? Like, what's the mechanics of, if you're saying it's not necessarily like the traumatic things that are most highly correlated to pain, if it's like really the lack of movement, what are the possible connections there? Other, you know, is it all like a use it or lose it kind of thing? You're not using a joint, so it's just going to degrade?
Well, I mean, there's lots of possible scenarios. So usually when we're talking about chronic pain, we're not talking about tissue that's you know, that has a pathology. So of course that does happen, right? So if you have arthritis and, you know, that's a thing, and then so they have chronic pain from arthritis, that's a different story than somebody who has low back pain or, you know, fibromyalgia, and they don't really know why it's happening. But it seems like it's connected much more to psychology. It's connected to endocrinology, immunology. So, you know, I think we'll probably find that there's different kinds of things that we all call chronic pain. And it's a little bit of a problem that we're trying to just put it into one basket. So, you know, is the problem that there is something going on with the tissues where the receptors are too sensitive? Is that because of an immune response? You know, that's a different problem than, well, we have, you know, neurons in the spinal cord that aren't firing, or we have the signals coming down that aren't inhibiting when they're supposed to. You know, a person who just generally has a psychology of everything's going to be all right is going to be different than somebody who has a psychology of things don't usually turn out very well. So
how is you as a practitioner, like, do you address those two differences? Like, what do you do differently?
You know, of course, you wouldn't tell a person what it is because you don't know. But if you can identify, are there certain patterns? Like, what does this always happen? Like, every time you do a certain movement, you know, we can start to think, okay, this has more to do with that location regionally versus, oh, do you notice that you have this more often when you don't get enough sleep, when you eat certain things, when you have, you know, more stress? Because a lot of people think it's just random. Well, this thing just happens to me. And because our culture and because most of healthcare is focused on this tissue-based model of a problem is tissue-based, and therefore we're going to solve it tissue-based. Like, we're going to do the foam rolling because it's going to fix the tissue, but it's not the tissue. We're actually just providing sensation that overrides the pain signals or changes those pain signals. If you start to understand, hey, it's not your disc. I know you saw that on a picture from your chiropractor, but guess what? Most people have that same disc issue and they're fine. So, but it's very easy story to believe. Like, oh, I saw this picture where my disc is this way, so therefore that's where my pain is, that they must be correlated, that they must be causally related. If it's really helpful to tell people, but actually that might not be the case, because if you think that it is the case that those are related, well, what are you going to do? You know, I guess that's, you know,
giving up control.
Yeah. If people have agency to realize, hey, if you start to realize that, you know, you have this pain every day, but when you went to Disney, you were fine. You know, so what is that about? It means that there's this other component that is contributing to it. Or, hey, when you went, you know, on your vacation to the Bahamas, it was fine. So what's that about? You know, if it was really about your disc, then that wouldn't be the case. And they start to realize that, then that gives them some agency to...
And then where do you go from there? Like, let's say somebody acknowledges, okay, there's a mental or emotional component to this, some psychological component that I've been, you know, either overlooking or my subconscious has been hiding it from myself for a long time. And now I acknowledge there might be something there. What does somebody do?
Well, you kind of optimize that. What you figure out what that optimal piece is. I mean, there's a psychotherapy element to there, maybe, although research consistently doesn't show a relationship, but I think that has because due to the problems of actually researching that. I don't want anyone to think that this is just all psychological. I mean, there are many different components. I mean, I think there's an endocrine component. The stress response is an endocrine component.
Wait, can you elaborate on that? What do you mean? An endocrine component to chronic pain? How does that work?
So we tend to think of the nervous system and the circulatory system and the endocrine system. These are all different systems and they act kind of separately from each other. But when we have endocrine responses, those hormones that are released change the firing patterns of neurons. They affect the signaling in the synapse. They affect the signaling along the way, along the axon. So if you have these stress responses, they sometimes create like less inhibition when they're supposed to have inhibition. They change the thresholds. So this is how a stress, like we usually just talk about stress responses in this very abstract, ambiguous way, But you have to understand that there's this chemical, you know, this cascade that changes the pain pathways in the moment. So if we can do things, we can't live stress-free. Not that that's the goal here, but if you realize, hey, maybe there's some things that I can do in my life that does reduce stress, that's another piece where you can start to take control.
That's interesting. I haven't heard that connection. So do you know what hormones specifically, Mark, modulate or regulate that those firing pattern changes? Is that like the steroid hormones?
There's a number of them, and that's where I start to get beyond my expertise at that level. Every so often, I tell myself, okay, I'm going to learn all these biological markers, and then I try, and I'm more of an anatomist and a psychology person, so that level starts to escape me.
So do you combine those with a client at the same time where, I mean, or at least when you were practicing now, I understand you're teaching teachers, I guess, or teaching practitioners. I mean, is there an opportunity where you have someone on the table and you are working on the anatomy and you're doing like some style of psychotherapy to integrate those?
No, definitely not. That would be out of scope. Part of it is about education to let people know, hey, you know, a lot of people have this and they don't have pain. It's just because you have this doesn't mean that that's actually what it is. We can't diagnose. We can't tell them your doctor's wrong or something. But, you know, I think a lot of people have no idea that that's even a possibility, that they aren't related. So just opening up that possibility, hey, you might, you know, read this, check this out, might give people some, you know, a hook on agency. So, you know, and the same thing with immune responses and endocrine responses to help people sort this out. But psychologically, you know, you could say, hey, well, do you notice that this is worse at different times? Oh, yeah, I guess it does kind of seem to be worse when this happens in my life. So, you know, you've just changed it. You've just given them a way to help themselves.
Just by shining a light on that, and they could ask different questions.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that these are the only ways. There's also medications that are better than, you know, the prescribed medications, the opioids that, you know, that aren't addictive. You know, there's really, really interesting research now with ketamine and oxytocin that shows a lot of promise.
Like people just taking oxytocin?
Mm-hmm.
So oxytocin, that's like the love hormone, or that's like what you feel when you get a long hug or something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's that?
Safety.
Gotcha. Are there what other times or does that occur, or are there other actions that oxytocin is like responsible for, that you know?
Yeah, well, 30 years ago, he would have said that oxytocin is just about like breastfeeding and orgasm. But now we know that it's involved with pretty much anything that's affiliative, attachment. I mean, petting a dog, getting a massage, giving
really?
A hug.
Interesting.
You know, people doing things that just build affiliation. It's a useful for building bonds. It has a dark side too. It also contributes to like polarization. So the degree to which I feel like I'm part of us is also the degree to which I feel like they are part of them.
Oh, so like cultural divides.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, you know,
because you feel that attachment with your tribe and the oxytocin reinforces that.
Yeah. But in terms of chronic pain, you know, you can see how it could be useful to, so a person who's had, you know, as PTSD, you know, there's going to be, you know, oxytocin is going to be really useful. Oxytocin is used for PTSD therapy to help bring a person back to a calmer state where they feel more safe. So, you know, in a state where you don't feel safe, you're going to be generating chemistry, but also neural activity that is not conducive to reducing pain. So oxytocin is going to work against
that. Mark, how is oxytocin delivered? Like, how do people take that?
It's an inhalant, a spray.
Into the mouth or nose?
Nose. There may be also a pill, too. I think there is a pill, too. Yeah.
So nasal spray. So that probably works pretty fast, then.
Mm-hmm.
Have you used that? Have you tried it?
No, I haven't.
Do you need a prescription for that?
Yes.
That's interesting. And are those generally, like, low doses, or is it?
I don't know anything about dosages.
Huh. So,
but there is research on chronic pain and oxytocin. It's very new.
So if somebody that was in pain wanted to explore that, Is that something that that most pain docs are? I assume most pain docs are not tinkering with that. Like,
no, that's not going to be a common thing to find. I don't have any great suggestions.
Gotcha. Because the ketamine I've heard a lot about, but it also seems, I would think that there's a lot of people that when they hear about that aren't ready to take that process or that on because of what else comes with it potentially. But yeah, oxytocin, I feel like the risk of having an too intense or bad experience would be really low.
Yeah. I mean, I also don't think that the risk of a bad experience with the ketamine dosages are that high. I you know, if you do it the way they're suggesting to do it.
Does that have an addictive effect though, the ketamine?
My understanding is that there are people who do not have addictive effects. I can't speak with authority on this though.
But oxytocin is like something your body's already naturally making. Like it's,
yeah.
Whereas ketamine, we don't.
People obviously, right. People obviously do ketamine like party drugs. That's not what I'm suggesting.
Right.
I'm suggesting a controlled, prescribed thing to check out.
I understand. Is there anything else in that category, like non-opiate alternatives, whether they're, I don't know, supplements, herbs, other medications?
Well, I mean, there's cannabinoids too. You know, there are people who have THC medications, you know, medical marijuana. That obviously has its downsides as well. But the reason that they use those, that system that goes from the brain down to the spinal cord to inhibit signals that should be inhibited, that and is that system being dysfunctional with fibromyalgia, for instance, the chemistry of that requires dopamine, it requires norepinephrine, it uses cannabinoid receptors. So when people get chronic pain medications or anxiety medications, they're working with those receptors. That's why they, like, oftentimes chronic pain patients get medications that are anxiety medications because they're working with the same chemistry. So that's why the cannabinoids fit into that, because it's part of that same tract, neural tract.
Interesting. So do they do things also to just try to raise dopamine then?
Yep. Neurochemistry is very complicated. You know, it's hard to think of it. You can't think of it in terms of just raising and lowering things, because there's different receptors and they do different things. So yeah.
Does cannabinoids, when someone's using that for pain, does that also, I don't know if desensitize is the right word in that respect, but does it lose its like punch over time where they need to use more, or it loses its effect?
I don't know.
So those are also like natural things that our body makes for, so that is something that our body is supposed to naturally be tinkering with to help manage our pain endogenously.
Right. We have those cannabinoid receptors. They're part of that system.
Gotcha. That also feels...
I'm not saying, hey, y'all, you know, you should do this. I'm not prescribing. I'm just trying to explain, like, why these are used and, you know, how that pain system works. And you know, some people find that they're successful and they don't work for other people.
But if there's, like, a strong emotional component from, like, past stuff, childhood stuff, I would think that regardless what you're using to help you, I don't want to say numb, but suppress, inhibit those pain signals, I wouldn't say it's like just helping you keep everything swept under the rug. Like it's helping you get through the day, but if there's something deep down there that pain is arising from, it's not going to suppress that signal coming up, even though you might be able to affect it, pushing it down, if you will, like inhibiting top down. It doesn't stop it rising from the bottom up if you don't do some other modality, whether it's talk therapy, to change your relationship with yourself in regards to those past experiences.
Sure. I mean, you have to work with what you can, what you're capable of tolerating. So, I mean, sometimes there's this idea that we have to feel everything to heal, which is, you know, it's not that simple. We don't want to just throw people into the feeling pool to see if they can swim.
That could backfire for some.
Yeah. But I mean, I certainly agree that it's, you know, to whatever extent one can, you know, address those things that could be useful, but we don't want to force people to address things that they can't.
Gotcha. Anything else you'd like to share on this topic of pain? Any other things that you spent a lot of time thinking about on this that you think is important?
Well, I think that it is important to realize that some of the things that we do are simply helping in the moment, and that's good. We don't need to think that the only good things are the things that fix them permanently. It's good to have things that provide respite occasionally. And sometimes, you know, just getting that leg up for a small amount of time is kind of bootstrapping ourselves, you know, rather than just falling into this, oh my gosh, it's never going to get better. You know, just doing something that feels good. I'm saying this because I hear a lot of people say, well, I don't want to do things that just help people for a little bit. And I think, well, sometimes that's actually what people need, because the problem itself is too hard to just fix. There is no fix that can happen today. It's a long fix. So, but sometimes in order to endure the long fix, you need these things to prop yourself up from day to day. A lot of the things that we do, we're not fixing tissues. We're just providing sensation that feels good or blocks pain signals. And that's good. That's useful.
That opens a window for someone to go through. Like, it clears a little space.
Yeah.
Well, that's great advice. So you teach practitioners how to deploy these different techniques, and that's through courses, like online courses, or how do you do that?
Yeah, I have a number of courses, trauma-informed care and the neuroscience of pain, posture and body work, and other topics on interoception. And yeah, so I want people to understand how these things work. So if you're a geeky person who likes to understand neuroscience and psychology, that's what I'm doing. But I also do it in a way that is accessible. You don't have to have a degree to take my classes. Anybody could take my classes. And I like to take the hard neuroscience material and provide a way to translate it to anybody.
So is this suitable for someone that just suffers from pain that doesn't?
Yeah, absolutely. Isn't,
okay. Where do they find these?
At my website, which is drolson.com. That's drolson.com.
Okay. And we will link to that in the show notes.
Thanks.
And are they all like online kind of on-demand style courses, or are there like live interaction where you're showing? How does it work?
I have some on-demand courses and I have some live courses. So a little bit of both.
Oh, great. And do you do these in person also? Is it all over internet?
I mostly do it internet, but I also can do those classes online too. I mean, in person as well.
Okay.
I don't have any schedule, but yeah.
Gotcha. Well, Mark, I really appreciate you taking your time and coming on and chatting about these. Definitely some interesting things. You got my interest. Definitely. I mean, the oxytocin thing is I'm really thinking about. I just wonder, like, I want to like see that in action where someone that has chronic pain and then takes a sniff of that, I'm like, what happens there? There's a couple things you talk about that really are interesting to me, and that's definitely one of them. Like, I feel like there's people in my life I want to reach out to and say, ask your doc about this.
Yes, absolutely. I don't think it's kind of a do this and you're going to feel better at that moment kind of thing. It's going to be a little bit of a time period.
But like when I think of my father, for instance, clearly his pain signal changing based on his environment, based on like who's in his environment. You know, is he watching the news getting upset, or is he like with a loved one? Like there's a clear difference. So if you could intervene at that like hormonal level of what you get from that, like what would that do? Does that mean you could cut a pain med by 50%, or like can it be something that could be worked into the program slowly? And like what are the other far-reaching benefits of that aside from the pain that you're probably not going to get from an opiate?
Absolutely. Yep. So if there's something about the oxytocin system that could be boosted, or, you know, or that is deficient, you know, that's part of the problem, that's going to be useful. But if their problem is something to do with the receptors at the tissues, then maybe they won't be as useful, you know, so that's
maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, I appreciate your time. And for the listeners, always grateful for your listening. I encourage you to check out Dr. Olson's work.